Chapter 41 Master Spirit. Even as he circumnavigated the globe, Grant had worried about resurgent Southern Democrats back home, ex-Confederates who had recaptured control of every state in the region and threatened to undo everything he had accomplished. "It looks to me that unless the North rallies by 1880, the government will be in the hands of those who tried so hard, 17 years ago, to destroy it," he wrote. Grant regretted the rise of the Solid South and deemed it his duty to save the results of the war. He also feared that unreasoning Southern resistance to Northern capital doomed the region to economic stagnation. Grant's travels also made him eager to introduce consular reforms, international arbitration, closer ties between China and Japan, new trade agreements, and a more international role for the United States. Finally, he was concerned about labor unrest and the rash of railroad strikes that had roiled the Hayes administration, nearly paralyzing the economy. For these reasons, Grant felt a direct personal stake in the 1880 election. As he traveled, he was rejuvenated by his renewed popularity at home. He had never lost the ability to draw on lingering affection from Appomattox. As the Times of London explained, American voters were disillusioned with President Hayes for failing to deliver on civil service reform, and realized that Grant, for all his errors, had hewed to a firm and honorable policy. This reevaluation made Grant the most popular American, and if the Republican nominating convention for 1880 were now to meet, would give him the nomination. Julia Grant perked up at the exuberant crowds who turned out for her husband. "They understand now and are sorry," she told her children, and longed to reign again as Washington's social doyen. When the British governor in Singapore had asked about her plans to return to the White House, she had made no secret of her ardent wish for a comeback, adding that if her husband heard her say so, "he would knock my head off." Two people who watched Grant's resurrection with enthusiasm were his old comrades, Sheridan and Sherman. "He has grown wonderfully in public confidence as an able and strong man," Sheridan wrote as Grant sailed the seas, "and it would not surprise me a bit if he was called upon to again go to the White House." More surprising had been the rediscovery of Grant's merits by Sherman. "No man of either party seems to rise above mediocrity or to command public confidence," Sherman wrote in October 1878. "If this continues 2 years more, Grant may again be president, and too vigorous to remain idle, he cannot well refuse." Right before Grant returned to America, Sherman posted to him a long, thoughtful letter describing how Southern leaders threatened to reverse the progress of Reconstruction and ignore the laws made in pursuance of the new amendments to the Constitution. Such inflammatory rhetoric, Sherman argued, would have made Grant an inevitable Republican candidate for 1880. But that Democratic threat had now receded, and with it the need for a third Grant term. The underlying point of the letter was to notify Grant that if Sherman's brother John should be a candidate for president, it would be unnatural for me to oppose or qualify his purpose. When he received this letter in Tokyo, Grant was deeply moved by Sherman's sensitivity in explaining why he might be forced to support his brother. With tears in his eyes, he told Young, "People may wonder why I love Sherman. How could I help loving Sherman? And he has always been the same during the 35 years I have known him. He was so at West Point." In 1879, a book by an anonymous author appeared with the provocative title, "The Great American Empire, or General Ulysses S. Grant, Emperor of North America." Whether or not Grant lusted for power, and he was careful to conceal any evidence of that, he could never admit it, and preferred to be carried along in the political current by friends more openly interested in power. He had a way of standing back and letting things happen, a tacit form of approval. Inaction had become his preferred form of action. That Grant leaned toward a third term was evident from his unending appearances across the country and the fact that John Russell Young rushed out his book about Grant's round-the-world tour in time for Christmas 1879. At the same time, Grant pleaded with Badeau to speed up publication of his military history of his wartime campaigns. "I think you cannot get it out too soon after your return to America," he lectured him in late November. "It will be the most authentic book published on the war, and I think the most truthful history." Buck advanced a subtler view of his father's ambivalent mood about another presidential race. While father was abroad, his political friends arranged that he should try again for the third term, and had gone so far in their arrangements that when he returned, he felt, in justice to them, that he ought to go on. The presidency was not a thing to be sought for, neither was it a thing to be refused. He never sought position, but when it came to him, he felt it his duty to accept if he could fill the place. He was also incapable of supposing his friends to be selfish. On December 19th, President Hayes conceded in his diary that Grant was the general popular favorite in the Republican Party, trailed by Senator James G. Blaine of Maine and Secretary of the Treasury John Sherman. Washburn concurred that the Republican vote for Grant will be so overwhelming that Blaine will get out of the road. Blaine and Sherman were favored by reform-minded party members who opposed machine politics and were dubbed half-breeds. Grant detractors already poured scorn on the idea of a third term. E.L. Godkin of The Nation mocked Grant's supporters as those seeking a permanent or nearly permanent president, and ridiculed the notion that foreign travel had produced a new, improved version of the scandal-ridden Grant. Still searching for a permanent abode, Grant spent the final days of 1879 at a friend's home in Washington. He hoped Buck would make a speculative killing for him in an Arizona mine, enabling him to buy a suitable residence in the capital. In late December, Grant undertook an invasion of the South, this time a purely peaceful one, visiting Columbia, South Carolina, and addressing a black militia in Beaufort. The trip barely camouflaged his political agenda to demonstrate that he could break the Democratic grasp on the region and carry some Southern states, a view buttressed by endorsements from a handful of Southern newspapers. Delighted by his friendly reception in the South, Grant and Julia boarded a steamer to St. Augustine, Florida. While in Florida, Grant associated openly with the temperance movement for the second time, meeting in Fernandina with a black lodge of the Independent Order of Good Templars. "General Grant," a lodge spokesman said, "the black men are not unmindful of the great good you rendered in the darkest days of the race's history, when there was but one real peril that threatened our nation's glory, slavery." In reply, Grant dwelled on a topic he had never dared broach so freely before, that he thought intoxicating liquors the chief cause of poverty and crime. Once again, Grant's courage in identifying with the temperance cause suggests a mastery over his drinking problem, and hence a new willingness to acknowledge it. During his two-week Florida stay, he also gushed about the state's economic future. "This is becoming a great resort for invalids and people who wish to avoid the rigors of a northern winter," he told his daughter. Grant decided to spend a goodly portion of the winter in Cuba and Mexico, taking Fred and his wife Ida, Phil Sheridan and his wife, and Catherine Felt, the daughter of Galena Friends. With John Russell Young, Grant had learned the art of taking along a chronicler who might convert a private trip to public advantage, and he now chose Byron Andrews of the Chicago Interocean as his secretary. In an oppressively hot Havana, the Grant party was handsomely entertained at the governor's palace, then toured tobacco and sugar plantations. After arriving in Veracruz, Mexico, on February 18th, Grant was welcomed by Matias Romero, the former Treasury Minister. Writing home, Grant made clear that his absence from America had a patently political objective. We will be back in the United States about the 22nd of March, by which time public opinion will be sufficiently developed for me to determine my duty. Those backers who argued that Grant had returned prematurely from his foreign travels now hoped his southern detour would enable them to rekindle a Grant boom when he returned in the spring. From the moment he set foot in Mexico, Grant was transported by the beautiful scenery, perfect climate, and hospitable people, exactly as during the Mexican War. On February 23rd, he and Sheridan held a cordial meeting with President Porfirio Diaz in Mexico City, and Grant again showed his talent for defining a brand new diplomatic role for superannuated presidents. He could speak more frankly than when in office, and addressed long-standing Mexican suspicions about the United States, telling Diaz frankly that our country had dealt harshly with his in years past, and that although I had been in the military service at the time, I had always felt that the war was unjust. A true friend of Mexico, Grant foresaw the day when it would become a rich country, a good neighbor, and the two republics would profit by the contact. Most of Mexico stood as virgin territory for railroad development, and Grant agreed to aid the country in developing a rail network with American capital. While in Mexico City, Grant relived a pair of battles now three decades in the past. Riding in mule-drawn carriages, he and his retinue drove 9 miles south of Mexico City to where Grant had fought at Churubusco in 1847. "Right here among these haciendas," he announced, alighting from his carriage, "my command lay all day waiting for the Battle of Contreras to be fought." He also revisited Molino del Rey and beheld ancient walls still pockmarked with bullets and cannonballs from that conflict. The spot had never shed its youthful romance for Grant. As the intervening years fell away, he came alive in relating the story. "As Grant stood up in the carriage," wrote a reporter, "he talked about the fight, and his face wore an expression of eager animation such as I have never observed through its mask of immobility before." During Grant's Mexican sojourn, Washburn reassured him he would win the nomination by acclamation at the Republican convention in Chicago, but he also sounded some alarming notes. People worried about overturning George Washington's precedent of restricting the president to 2 terms. "Of course the Copperheads howl over it," Washburn wrote, "and now the opposition of our own party is howling still louder." Grant was being portrayed in the press as a captive of party bosses who manipulated him for their own ends. "Many of those who desired Grant do not want him as the candidate of the Camerons and Conklings, secured by manipulated caucuses and pledged delegations," the New York Times cautioned. About the auspices under which he might secure the nomination, Grant showed scant concern, having long ago cast his lot with the Conklings and the Camerons, and it was too late to undo the damage. To Washburn, Grant insisted it was a matter of supreme indifference whether he was nominated or not. But crossing the border into Texas in late March, he looked suspiciously like an energetic, barnstorming candidate, sometimes giving 4 or 5 speeches a day that plainly declared his intentions, and he exhibited an oratorical prowess that floored those who remembered the old, nervous, tongue-tied Grant. At a Galveston banquet, Grant invoked his service in Texas during the Mexican War, singing the state's praises. "I am glad to come back now on this occasion to behold a territory which is an empire in itself and larger than some of the empires of Europe." Visiting a school for African Americans, Grant promoted education for blacks and the vital importance of an educated citizenry. "I am glad to see that the colored children of Galveston have the opportunity of becoming useful citizens and hope that you will improve it by obtaining a common school education, and that the white children will do likewise." In Houston, hundreds of blacks mobbed Grant at the local hotel, while one stooped, white-haired black preacher spread out his long, bony hand and pronounced his blessing upon him, said a spectator. Everywhere in the South, the ubiquitous Grant stopped at African-American schools and churches, engendering a fervent outpouring of support from black citizens whom he had assiduously courted over the years. When he spoke to the black congregation of a Methodist church in New Orleans, the large, eager crowd spilled into the surrounding streets. "The South has been the home of the colored man," Grant stated, "and I hope he will always be permitted to live peaceably in the South, freely." Grant's concern for the black community melded altruism with self-interest, for black Republican votes could wrest several Southern states from Democratic hands. As James Longstreet told a reporter with enthusiasm, "There are Southern states which one Republican and one alone can carry, and that one is General Grant. North Carolina, Louisiana, Georgia. Yes, it is possible for Grant to carry Georgia." "Why not? Almost half the population of the state are Negroes, every man of them Republicans at heart." Among whites, Grant's Southern tour inspired divergent reactions. In Mobile, former mayor Jones Withers, once a Confederate general, extolled the tour as the grand crowning act of an eventful life in which Grant had exhorted his countrymen to rise above sectional animosity and party strife to his own high level of pure patriotism and true statesmanship. Striking a similar note, the Memphis Appeal wrote, "We are, let us hope, upon the threshold of the new era, when all trace of the bloody contest will be blotted out." But many Southern whites resented Grant's presence, had not forgotten his wartime ferocity, and blamed him for Reconstruction, placing him beyond forgiveness or redemption. "Unless our people have eaten of the insane root and lost their reason, Grantism can have no foothold at the South," the Mobile Register declared. "We have not yet become dogs to lick the hand that smites us." Reprising the familiar charge of bayonet rule, the Louisiana Senate voted down a resolution welcoming Grant to the state. Grant knew the symbolic importance of a peaceful trip through a region in which he had waged bloody war and balanced appearances before black audiences with amicable speeches before white ones. At numberless banquets, he expatiated on national unity and paid tribute to Southern generals who stepped forward to thank him for his generosity at Appomattox. The reconciliation theme crested in Vicksburg, where Grant joked he was glad to go to Vicksburg through the front door. "Once, you know, I was forced to come in through the back door." 17 years after bombarding the starving city, Grant personified a spirit of renewal. "I know that nothing can again array the blue against the gray. This fact is proven by the citizens coming here today, white and colored, together." Another emotional high point came in Cairo, Illinois, where Grant recalled that when he last inhabited the town, it had been a camp of bristling bayonets. He reminded listeners that on his southern swing, former Confederate officers had expressed satisfaction with the war's outcome, "and I in no wise felt inclined to attempt to disturb them." Grant's newfound Southern popularity made it seem feasible that, as a presidential candidate, he might peel away several states from the Democratic grip. The black community nationwide lined up wholeheartedly behind his candidacy, one black journalist calling Grant the only man who can silence the copperhead element in the South. Starting in Cairo, Grant's itinerary through Illinois was largely orchestrated by Washburn, who wished to expose the undeclared candidate to as many towns as possible. Grant suffered from a lost tooth, and Julia's eye problem bothered her again, but otherwise the trip went well. The stalwarts made no secret that Grant was their pet, their creature, their best bet for a return to power. "General Grant is in the hands of his friends," John Logan bragged to a reporter, "and they will not withdraw him until he is beaten, no matter how many ballots are taken." On April 27th, when Grant celebrated his 58th birthday in Galena, townspeople trooped through his house, now a temporary oasis for a former president with no fixed address. Young claimed that he and Grant knocked about the country together like a pair of boys on a holiday. I never saw him better or in better form. By April 1880, Adam Badeau thought opposition to Grant's nomination had hardened because of his premature return from his world tour. He also believed Grant's reticence about a third term and ingrained passivity damaged his chances at the forthcoming convention. According to Badeau, men like Conkling, Cameron, and Logan declared in intimate conferences that Grant had never said to either that he would be a candidate. He had done nothing whatever to promote his first nomination, and nothing directly for his second, and he determined now to follow the same course in regard to a third. Months spent on the road had strengthened Grant's determination to return to the White House, as if acting at being president made him want to be president again. Staying at Fred's house in Chicago in May, weeks before the convention, Grant executed an atypical volte-face. He threw off all pretense of neutrality and declared his wish to nab the nomination. Badeau was thunderstruck. Grant manifested as much anxiety as I ever saw him display on his own account. He calculated the chances, he counted the delegates, considered how every movement would affect the result. The foreign policy ideas about China, Japan, and Mexico that fermented in his brain gave him a valid reason to want to return to the presidency instead of falling back on pure egotistical desire, which had never satisfied his Methodist soul. Painfully aware of his mistakes as president, Grant fantasized about re-entering the White House to correct those errors and redeem his reputation. Beyond his sudden daydreams of returning to power, Grant was goaded to run by Julia, and it was widely bruited in the press that the general would rather offend 40 million people than Madame. Right before the Chicago convention, a filthy man in ragged clothes walked the city streets, making a public spectacle of himself.
"I am U.S. Grant's brother," the drunken derelict told startled pedestrians. "Don't I look like him?"
The shabby vagrant was Orville Grant, and he spoke the plain truth. With a wife and four children, Orville was a genial man with a full beard, large forehead, and close-set blue eyes. Right before Grant became president, Orville's vindictive wife had tried to borrow money from Julia and gotten a rough reprimand. As she recalled, Julia became indignant. She had a hot temper, mind you, and said that Orville had gotten a great deal of money from Father Grant, that Ulysses had gotten none because he had earned his way, and if Orville had squandered such riches, that was not her fault, and she would not make up the difference. In 1872, after Grant appointed James McLean, Orville's partner in the Galena leather business, collector of the Port of Chicago, he was stunned to discover that McLean had forked over kickbacks to Orville to procure the job.
"I did not dream that such obligation existed," Grant protested. Despite bad blood, he had promised a year later to give his younger brother $5,000 or $10,000 when he entered a new business. Still, Orville proved an embarrassment, cutting shady deals for Indian trading posts, and he also seemed to share his brother's problematic drinking history. He was firmly in the mold of Jesse Root Grant, working every angle to exploit his brother's celebrity. Orville's erratic behavior acquired new significance in September 1878, when the Grant family had him committed to the State Asylum for the Insane in Morristown, New Jersey. Two constables grabbed him at a train station, a reporter describing him as a rather tall man who wore a somewhat seedy black beaver hat and whose clothes were untidy. Accompanied by a family physician, Dr. Morton, the constables hustled off a dazed Orville to the Elizabeth jail and then to the asylum, where he feverishly paced the floor, jabbering about speculative ventures. The press exploded with stories about hallucinations that had seized him, all revolving around crazy money-making schemes. The outcast brother had turned into a walking caricature of Jesse Root Grant at his most avaricious. He imagined he had bought enormous quantities of calfskin, or pianos, or sewing machines, or wheat, cornering the market. Dr. Morton called the delusions purely an intellectual aberration and denied they were related to alcohol. To discuss Orville's case, a New York Times reporter sought out Hannah Grant, then living with the Corbins in Elizabeth. She is a gentle-mannered old lady with an abundance of silver-gray hair and a face as kind and motherly as it is delicate and finely cut. Mrs. Grant said that her son, Orville, had been a trouble to the family for some time. If he could have been persuaded to remain quietly at home, no restraint would have been put upon his actions, for he was a kind husband and father, and there was no apprehension that his mania would take a violent turn. His insanity consisted in a monomania for immense transactions without any capital. He had spent or invested in unremunerative enterprises nearly or quite all the $50,000 he had formerly made in the timber business, and she did not think there would be anything left for the maintenance of the family. According to the article, Grant had taken Orville's case to a distinguished alienist, who concluded that quiet surveillance by friends would suffice instead of forcible restraint. During his global trip, Grant monitored Orville's behavior at the asylum, finding nothing to hearten him. "I am sorry to say that I do not get favorable news from Orville," he told a relative in December 1878. "He does not seem to improve." For reasons that are murky, weeks after Grant wrote this letter, Orville was released from the asylum and turned up on Philadelphia's streets, boasting of big business plans ahead in San Francisco. Not only was he going to open a great restaurant, reported the New York Times, but he had several $100,000 invested in a Pacific Slope tannery, another immense sum in a brewery, and was in partnership with several parties in other concerns. Although shut up in a dream world, Orville was affable as he endeavored to strike business deals, but his clothes were shabby, his shoes begrimed with mud. By August, he had drifted to Chicago, where he showed up right before the Republican convention, presenting a public relations nightmare for his brother. As one Grant supporter wrote, "Brother Orville is here, and you ought to see him, a perfect wreck from liquor, and in a ragged, drunken, collarless state, almost without shoes, and his clothes in the most disgusting condition. He walks the street and is observed of everybody. It is an outrage upon the American people that the general should permit this." Grant didn't spurn his brother, and his willingness to tolerate his presence typified his reaction to his most trying family members. Whatever they did, he stuck loyally by them, or at least did not disown them. But Grant showed no enduring affection for his brother, who had disappointed him so many times. When Orville died in August 1881, at age 46, he did not attend the funeral. In the prelude to the Republican convention, scheduled to convene in Chicago on June 2, 1880, Ulysses S. Grant exuded a confident air, convinced voters would give him a fresh chance at the White House. "The general is now here feeling first rate," wrote Elihu Washburn from Galena in late April. "Calm as a summer morning and feeling fully assured of success, the same as we all feel." Grant refused to campaign, wanting the nomination to come to him without any unseemly show of desire on his part. The ladylike Julia, by contrast, favored a more bare-knuckled approach. So hopeful were the pro-Grant omens that on May 21st, the New York Times termed his nomination certain, citing an influential politician who contended he had locked up a commanding 380 convention votes. One naysayer was John Russell Young, who met with Grant in late May and tried to convince him he couldn't be reelected. In response, Grant drafted a letter for the four politicians who would supervise his nomination in Chicago, Conkling, Boutwell, Cameron, and Logan, and volunteered to withdraw if needed to stem any bitterness generated by his candidacy. His one condition was that he would bow out only if James Blaine did so as well. When Julia got wind of this letter, she was irate, telling Young, If General Grant were not nominated, then let it be so, but he must not withdraw his name. No, never.
The letter was delivered in a large envelope to Fred Grant, who claimed he passed it on to Conkling. George Boutwell says Grant had already given the four men complete discretion to handle his candidacy as they thought advisable. In the end, Grant never withdrew. Quite amazing was the ardor with which Julia Grant prodded her husband to take off the kid gloves and fight hard for the nomination. When she urged him to go to Chicago and appear on the convention floor, he said he would rather cut off his right hand.
"Do you not desire success?" she asked.
"Well, yes, of course," he answered. "Since my name is up, I would rather be nominated, but I will do nothing to further that end."
Julia harrumphed at what she considered misguided chivalry.
"For heaven's sake, go! And go tonight. I know they are already making their cabals against you. Go, go tonight, I beseech you."
Grant grew exasperated.
"Julia," he declared, "I am amazed at you."
And he strolled off to chat with a visitor. On June 2nd, Senator James D. Cameron banged the gavel to open the Chicago convention. The first big floor fight erupted over a procedural point that could theoretically swing the nomination to Grant. With Conkling leading the charge, Grant forces lobbied for the unit rule, which would guarantee that three large states in the stalwart camp, New York, Illinois, and Pennsylvania, cast all their votes for a single candidate. James A. Garfield predicted a fierce fight over this seemingly technical issue. In a preview of things to come, the unit rule was defeated by a 449-306 vote, substantially lessening Grant's chances for victory and disclosing the first chinks in his electoral armor. The most conspicuous delegate on the convention floor was his manager, Roscoe Conkling, a tall, arresting figure who dominated attention. Blaine called him the master spirit of Grant's followers, and, with head held high, he lived up to that designation. When several delegates offered to back Conkling instead of Grant, he sharply upbraided them.
"I am here as the agent of New York to support General Grant to the end. Any man who would forsake him under such conditions does not deserve to be elected and could not be elected."
Lord Roscoe did not disappoint those who expected a flurry of showmanship. When he rose to nominate Grant, he leapt onto a table reserved for journalists, folded his arms across his chest, then waited until a hush had fallen. He began by softening up the crowd with some light verse. "When asked what state he hails from, our sole reply shall be, he comes from Appomattox and its famous apple tree." This set off an uproarious 10-minute celebration for Grant. "Never defeated in peace or in war," Conkling resumed. "His name is the most illustrious born by living man." When he mocked Grant's opponents and was greeted by derisory shouts, he blithely sucked on a lemon until the uproar had subsided. With his round-the-world tour, Conkling said, Grant had added knowledge and experience to profound common sense. He laughed at criticisms leveled at Grant. "The shafts and the arrows have all been aimed at him, and they lie broken and harmless at his feet." Then confronted head-on the view that no president should be entitled to a third term. "Who dares to put fetters on that free choice and judgment which is the birthright of the American people?" Conkling transported the delirious crowd beyond Grant's checkered presidency to the glory days of the Civil War, arousing them with military imagery. Such was the hysterical enthusiasm, a reporter wrote, that the friends of Grant threw away the characteristics of age and became boys once more. For all his glittering flashes of oratory, Conkling's presence played into the hands of those who thought Grant the cat's paw of party bosses. For them, the messenger trumped the message. After Conkling spoke, Garfield delivered a fine speech for John Sherman that somewhat cooled off Grant mania sweeping the hall. In the past, Conkling had clashed with Blaine, the darling of the half-breeds, taunting him for
his haughty disdain, his grandiloquent swell, his majestic, supereminent, overpowering turkey gobbler strut. A politician to his fingertips with a sonorous voice and magnetic personality, Blaine was cordial but calculating. Sometimes Grant viewed him charitably as a very able man, I think a perfectly honest man, fit for any place. But at other times he called Blaine a very smart man, and when I say that, I do not mean talented, but smart. Grant blamed Blaine for venomous attacks launched against him, and their friendship didn't survive the convention. Grant had never warmed to John Sherman, who reciprocated the feeling, warning that Grant's nomination would be fatal to us in the election. Moving silently in the background was Elihu Washburn, who claimed to favor Grant's nomination. Then articles surfaced in the St. Louis Globe-Democrat that the two-faced Washburn secretly promoted his own candidacy, leaving Grant hurt and dumbfounded. "Mr. Washburn is my friend," Grant told a reporter. "He has always been a very warm and sincere friend to me, and was at such a time when his friendship was so valuable that no matter what happens, I can never forget it, nor cease to remember it with gratitude." The winning candidate needed 379 votes. On the first ballot, Grant drew a narrow lead of 304 votes versus 284 for Blaine, 93 for Sherman, 34 for George F. Edmonds of Vermont, and, confirming Grant's worst fears, 30 for Washburn. These last votes, the unkindest cut for Grant, denied him an insuperable lead. The convention then wore on through many wearisome ballots, marked by trifling changes in the vote count. On the third ballot, two new names appeared with a single vote apiece, the Indiana politician Benjamin Harrison and Congressman James A. Garfield. Finally came the fateful 36th ballot, which produced a political earthquake. Perhaps feeling the tremors, Conkling admonished the Grant delegates, "Keep steady, boys. Grant is going to win on this ballot." During the roll call, Maine deserted Blaine, its favorite son, and switched all its votes to Garfield, setting off a delegate stampede in his direction. Grant's votes remained firm as Blaine and Sherman supporters alike defected to Garfield. When the counting ended, Garfield had 399 votes, Grant 306, Blaine 42, Elihu Washburn 5, and John Sherman 3. It was a startling victory for Garfield, who had never declared his candidacy, had stood four square behind Sherman, and was the most reluctant of Dark Horse nominees. Grant was in the office of William Rowley of his wartime staff when he learned his last presidential hopes were snuffed out. He stepped outside, puffed thoughtfully on a cigar, then told friends, "I can't say that I regret my own defeat. By it I shall escape 4 years of hard work and 4 years of abuse. And gentlemen, we can all support the candidate." One side of Grant was likely relieved, Grant telling Conkling he had grown weary of constant abuse, much of it emanating from former professed friends. Buck told how his father had reacted to Conkling's speech and the thunderous ovation it received. As they walked home afterward, an uneasy Grant turned and said a little sadly, "I'm afraid I may be nominated." Buck claimed his father lost the nomination because he refused to cut a side deal to retain John Sherman as Treasury Secretary. That Grant felt his defeat deeply grew clear when he failed to send a congratulatory message to Garfield. He felt duped by his backers, telling friends he would never have allowed his name to be used if he thought victory uncertain. "My friends were not just to me in saying that it was only a matter of form." With this defeat behind him, Grant would endorse a constitutional amendment limiting the president to 1 7-year term. Julia Grant felt bitterly the injustice of her husband's loss. Having been received with grand ceremony by monarchs and prime ministers around the world, she could not contemplate comfortably the return to a mundane civilian life. I take it as a personal grievance, she said of Garfield's victory, and I am down on Washburn and the whole caboodle of them. She told one friend, you know I'm a Democrat. What's more, I'm secesh, particularly as the Republicans wouldn't nominate Ulysses for a third term. Grant's loss perhaps owed less to insufficient popularity than to heavy-handed methods wielded by his henchmen Conkling, Logan, and Cameron, who ended up splitting the Republican Party. As Hayes wrote, the immediately valuable result is the condemnation of the machine as organized by Conkling and Cameron. I greatly regret that Grant, our first soldier and a man of many sterling qualities, should be so humiliated and degraded as he has been by his unprincipled supporters. The stalwarts could claim one victory in Chicago, the choice of Conkling's protege, Chester Arthur, the former collector for the Port of New York, as the vice presidential nominee, as a consolation prize to Conkling. Arthur, having stuck by Grant to the last minute, refused to rebuff the overture from the Garfield forces. When he informed Conkling about the job, the latter grew outraged that Arthur would even consider such a disloyal thing. Well, sir, Conkling roared, you should drop it as you would a red-hot shoe from the forge. Arthur, pained, would not be browbeaten. The office of the vice president is a greater honor than I ever dreamed of attaining. In a calmer moment you will look at this differently. Conkling was not appeased. Declaring his independence, Arthur accepted the nomination, and his decision would shortly transform a New York political hack into a president of the United States. A big, robust man with a long beard, James Abram Garfield was a remarkable autodidact, born in a log cabin in Ohio. An industrious student who worked at menial jobs to pay his way through school, he ended up a professor of ancient language, literature, and math, and a college president at age 26. After Fort Sumter, his ascent in the Union Army was no less rapid, as he fought at Shiloh and Chickamauga and served as chief of staff for General Rosecrans. In 1863, soon after becoming a major general of volunteers, he resigned to serve in Congress and wound up a champion of emancipation and civil rights for blacks. Though Garfield had long been a faithful Republican, Grant had never especially warmed to him, but neither had he criticized him. He is a good man, Grant commented after the convention, in a less than rousing endorsement. Garfield has always been right. During his southern tour, Grant had come to believe he could dent Democratic dominance in the region, whereas he saw no chance of Garfield making such inroads. When Democrats gathered in Cincinnati in late June and nominated Winfield Scott Hancock as their standard-bearer, Grant's attraction to Garfield intensified overnight. To a reporter, he sardonically recalled Hancock's vainglorious reaction to receiving a single vote at the 1864 Democratic Convention, recalling how, from that time, Hancock had had the presidential bee in his bonnet. Mocking Hancock as an inexperienced political lightweight, Republicans printed up a pamphlet entitled Hancock's Political Achievements, a work that contained nothing but blank pages. When the Chicago convention ended, Grant resumed his nomadic life, hoping to end up in New York City, if he could afford it. To escape hot weather, he returned to the Rocky Mountains, where Jesse had struck it rich in Arizona and New Mexico mining ventures. The newly extroverted Grant was much in demand, his appetite for public ceremonies never sated. In Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, Grant was asked if he ever tired of these events. Oh, no, he replied. I rather enjoy them if I could only get sleep enough. Wherever his train stopped on the Great Plains, huge assemblies of welcoming people gathered, and Democrats, no less than Republicans, honored him at banquets and parades. Grant was especially pleased to visit Colorado, which had recently become a state thanks to his signature on a bill late in his presidency. Inspecting gold and silver discoveries, he ventured some political humor when told that a Colorado creek was called Son of a Bitch Creek, and he suggested it be renamed Carl Schurz Creek. He provisionally accepted the presidency of the San Pedro Mining Company, a gold and copper producer, hoping its dividends would sustain him. "One thing is certain, I must do something to supplement my income or continue to live in Galena or on a farm," he confided to Badeau. "I have not got the means to live in a city." On June 22nd, Grant spurned a lucrative offer to become president of the new Panama Canal Company that was extended by Ferdinand de Lesseps, who had overseen creation of the Suez Canal. Though a spirited advocate of an interoceanic canal, Grant favored Nicaragua as the most practicable route from an engineering standpoint. Ever mindful of the Monroe Doctrine, he also wanted a canal created under American auspices. By December, Grant had emerged as a charter member of the new Maritime Canal Company of Nicaragua, with the expectation that he would soon become its president. Wherever he went, reporters eagerly solicited his views on the presidential race. In mid-July, he issued a thumping vote of confidence in Garfield. "There is no reason why any Republican should hesitate to define his position or not vote for Garfield. I know him to be a man of talent, thoroughly accomplished, and an upright man." Garfield was gleeful at the zest with which Grant had suddenly embraced him. "Certainly no American is so well able, by an experience wholly unequaled in our history, as you, to aid in bringing our people into harmony and ensuring the success of our party," Garfield flattered Grant. Grant sent back a robust letter of support, disclosing that he would return east around September 20th and suggesting that he and Garfield travel partway together. Grant was back in the game. On September 28th, he campaigned with Conkling in Warren, Ohio, and dazzled the crowd with a 7-minute speech. Startled by his sudden loquacity in public, the press began talking up the notion of a new Grant. He stayed at Garfield's home in Mentor, near Lake Erie, while Julia, resenting Garfield's triumph and believing her husband cheated of his rightful place in the universe, refused to join him. "The general went," she wrote with proud defiance, "but I would not go." Grant volunteered to campaign for Garfield in northeastern states and again blazed a new path for ex-presidents. Having sat out his own presidential races, he had never campaigned before or made speeches on the hustings and threw himself into the task with self-evident gusto. "We must elect Garfield," he exhorted a Cincinnati audience. "He is a great man. He has but few intellectual peers in public life." With his uncanny knack for self-reinvention, Grant turned into a master of the stump speech, condensing his thoughts into brief talks and prompting prolonged bursts of applause. As Mark Twain recalled, Grant was received everywhere by prodigious multitudes of enthusiastic people, and one might almost tell what part of the country the general was in by the red reflections on the sky caused by the torch processions and fireworks. On October 16th, Mark Twain escorted the born-again, whistle-stopping Grant from Boston to Hartford, where he introduced him to a vast audience in Bushnell Park. On the train, Fred Grant revealed to Twain that his father, far from being a rich man, as was commonly supposed, had not even enough income to enable him to live as respectably as a third-rate physician. Twain thought this disgraceful, and in introducing Grant, contrasted his financial plight with that of the pampered Duke of Wellington, so richly rewarded after Waterloo. England had made him a duke, and gave him $4 million. If you had done and suffered for any country what you have done and suffered for your own, you would have been affronted in the same sordid way. Twain joked to Grant, then added, "Your country loves you. Your country is proud of you. Your country is grateful to you." Grant had deployed his gift for dry humor in private, but now delighted audiences with droll commentary. At the New York Stock Exchange, he entertained brokers with humorous observations of their frenzied trading routines. "The first time I came here, I thought you were all fighting with one another, and if that were so, it was no place for me to be among fighting men. I am pleased to see you all and wish both bulls and bears success, and that you will all come out of this without a scratch. On October 21st, the man renowned for stoic silence squeezed three speeches into one hectic day.
I am hoarse today, he told a crowd in Stamford, Connecticut. Frequent speeches make one hoarse, I believe.
He kept up a brisk pace, more typical of lightning military strikes than electioneering forays, explaining in Franklin, New Jersey, that he believed the fate of the Republic was at stake, that all the blood and treasure spilled during the Civil War would be squandered by a Democratic victory. The great importance of this occasion has induced me to attend political meetings as I have never done before in my life. I have felt that I could not see the government in the hands of those who labored to destroy it. During his concluding 10 days of electioneering, Grant spoke with unwanted ebullience, dropping deep-seated inhibitions. Flashing his trademark silk hat and cigar, he was hoisted on the shoulders of delirious crowds. What became clear as he crossed upstate New York was that Grant wasn't just campaigning for a candidate, but for a cause. He was outraged that our fellow citizens of African descent in the South couldn't vote without being burned out of their homes and without being threatened or intimidated. He would not allow Democrats to control elections by the use of a shotgun and by intimidation and assassination. In Auburn, Grant spoke at two giant wigwams that held up to 10,000 people apiece, and blasted the Southern doctrine of states' rights, charging that the Democratic Party upheld the principles of Robert E. Lee and Andrew Johnson and stood under the control of rebel brigadiers. In a final burst of energy, he returned to New York City right before the election and stood with Chester Arthur at a nocturnal parade that lasted from midnight until 4 a.m. On election day, all of Grant's campaigning appeared to pay off. Garfield won by a wafer-thin margin in the popular vote column, but did better in the Electoral College, and Grant had good reason to believe he had made a signal contribution to Garfield's election. The country, in my judgment, has escaped a great calamity in the success of the Republican Party, Grant told his daughter. A month ago, the result attained was not expected. In a post-election interview, he again showed his newly acquired candor. If the South had once obtained a firm hold of the government, they would have ruined the country, and nothing short of a revolution would have rescued it from their hands again.